Damon, welcome back. How are you, man?
Kanye is Kanyeezy. You can call me Yeezy. What's going on, big dog?
Are you in a new video? You didn't make the new video, though, right? I mean, you didn't get in there.
I did not.
You're not in that one.
Cutting room floor, unfortunately.
Did you make Nails' book? Are you in the Best of Nails or whatever Lenny Dykstra's calling his book there? I mean, he outs everybody in that book. I haven't read it, though, yet, so I don't know if you got in that or not.
No, I was left out of that one as well, unless he was writing about me trying to emulate Dykstra's swing back in the backyard playing wiffle ball.
Yeah.
1987, 1988. Maybe then I made it, but other than that, I don't think so.
My favorite Lenny Dykstra story was when he was playing in Philadelphia, and they had that carpeting, the old kind of carpet, you know, that would, you know, the thin, the AstroTurf, the original AstroTurf. And of course, when he was in the Mets, this, when playing at Shea, this wasn't that big a deal. But out there, you know, Nails always had a big, huge chew in his mouth, right? And opposing center fielders say you'd go out into center field at Veterans Stadium, and it looked like a toxic waste dump. And they said that if it was just like huge, big, huge brown stain all over center field. And like you didn't even know where you try to line up and get away from it. And then if a ball got hit out there and hit the tobacco spit and squirt. The ball would squirt. You'd get the ball in your glove. You grab the ball and it would have like Lenny Dykstra tobacco juice on the ball when you tried to throw it in. That's pretty gross.
So Dykstra is kind of like one of the most grotesque human beings possible, both from his personal life and personal decisions and just how everything he touches turns to muck. And then that's kind of the perfect metaphor, right? Because it's as disgusting as his personal life, but in real, tobacco form that you would want to go nowhere near. I can't imagine trying to field a baseball with his tobacco spit all over it.
Yes, he is he's the tobacco spit of baseball history. Lenny Dykstra is that guy. But a lot of nervous people probably kind of thumbing through that thing, seeing if they're in there. I mean, he made a lot of people nervous when he put that book out.
Yeah, I could only imagine. It's kind of like those are the most dangerous people in your life or that you ever cross paths with. They're the ones that have nothing to lose, like a Jose Canseco, and now like a Dykstra. You just never know what they're capable of. You never know when something that you don't want out there, they just go, oh, who cares? I got nothing to lose.
All right, let me ask you a question. Damon Amendola joining us, CBS radio, and I assume he's in New York City. You're not off yet, right? Do you get a little holiday time here during it? Because I'm doing a show today, tomorrow, and then I'm gonzo until after the 4th of July. When are you going to be off?
Yeah, I got a 4-day weekend coming up, so I'll be on the air through Thursday, and then I'll be back after the 4th of July. But I got the next couple of nights on the air.
Now, with that deal going on in New York, right, the Copa America final, did you chuck that off of your bucket list? Did you go there to the Copa?
I did not. I mean, if the World Cup has always been something that I've really desperately wanted to go to, but the Copa obviously is a step below, so I never got around to it. And I, you know, it's a little bit more difficult than I would have liked anyway, just because working weeknights. If there was weeknight matches, I couldn't go anyway. But I could have made yesterday's match, the championship game, but sat it out. But I did watch it on television. But, the World Cup and the Euro Cup higher on my bucket list than the Copa Americana.
Do you know if Messi's penalty kick has come down yet? Has anybody seen that ball? He's getting crushed on the internet.
I think I just saw it pass over my apartment roof. I'm going to go retrieve it for him, see if he wants it back.
Some of the memes are quite hilarious. I just posted them at our Facebook fan page and on Twitter. Some of them are pretty funny, shooting stars and, you know, all kinds of other shots of it. And then Messi quits. Lionel Messi, if you missed it, says he's quitting the national team. 29 years old. He's not quitting, right? I mean, you know, he'll be there for World Cup qualifiers in September and things like that. I know there's a lot of crap going on with Argentina, too, though, politically and whatnot, but you can't, I mean, this is like a player right after a very emotional loss. There's no way that Messi's quitting the Argentina team, is there?
I don't think so. I think that it was a really emotional, raw moment for him. He's come so close so many times. 3 straight years he's lost in the final of a major international tournament. So I'm sure it kind of feels like, if I can't break through now, when am I going to break through? But at 29 years old, I got a very difficult time believing Messi, who I'm sure is going to play to at least nearly 40. Let's say he's got a good 8, 9, or 10 more years of soccer in him. Mm-hmm. I find it very hard to believe that he's going to be able to sit out two or three World Cups from here on out. I really don't buy it. It feels a lot like Michael retiring in 1993. That was after a win. This was after a loss. But, I mean, for him to step away right now just because of an emotional loss, I just don't think it's going to stick for his entire career.
David Amendola with us, CBS Sports Radio. All right, so the big trade last week for the Knicks, they get Derrick Rose. We talked about that. They bring that guy in, and people kind of raise an eyebrow and say, oh, that's kind of interesting. And Derrick Rose and Carmelo Anthony and Chris Porzingis here. He seems like, you know, this is a comer here with this guy. This is getting interesting. And then all of a sudden, the word comes out that the Knicks, at least according to Phil Jackson, telling Derrick Rose that they're going to put the full court press on Kevin Durant. Carmelo Anthony's talking Kevin Durant. This would change everything, wouldn't it? I mean, if they get KD to come to New York and join that squad, now all of a sudden this might become kind of the it thing in New York. No, just talk about what it would mean if the Knicks were to get Kevin Durant there.
Well, it would mean a lot. I mean, it would be like getting LeBron or Steph Curry, or would pick your superstar of the NBA to try to instantaneously raise the fortunes of a franchise that hasn't won a championship in 40-some-odd years. But it's not happening. There's absolutely zero chance that he's going to choose the Knicks.
Not even a little bit?
One, he's got a really great team with a great teammate in Oklahoma City. And the only reason he would leave, it's not for more money, he can get the most money there, is for a better winning situation. And I don't care if it's Carmelo of 2005 and Derrick Rose of 2007, this is not a better winning situation. It's just not. So could you convince me he could go to Golden State? Well, of course. If he goes to Golden State, I mean, they're instantaneously a team that could win three championships in a row. Could he go to Miami? I suppose he could go to Miami, but that's not a better situation than I think he's got in Oklahoma City right now. But the Knicks, what, Derrick Rose on half a knee, Carmelo Anthony into his 30s, and a completely unproven coach, Jeff Hornacek, for what? Why? Because of New York's glitz and glamour? Look, I'm a New Yorker. I think we are so blinded here in this city about what it means to be at the Garden, what it means to be a Knick. Everybody in the league knows what a buffoon James Dolan is. Everybody knows how dysfunctional this franchise is. So suddenly Kevin Durant's going to leave a really good place for one that's a total crapshoot, and you have no idea whether Carmelo's got two good years left or if Derrick Rose's knee's going to hold up. He's only under contract for one more season. He's going to leave a team that was within a win of the NBA Finals this year for the Knicks. No way. This is a total New York media ploy, making this something that it really isn't.
Oh, plus, he's in a market at OKC where that's the only pro franchise there. And, I mean, they would be terrified, you know, to say that, you know, he ate a salad for lunch if he had a burger. I mean, they wouldn't want to offend him. You know, New York, it's a whole nother animal. I'm not sure that he would want to deal with that. He is he's a Texas guy, you know, played at Texas, and he's right there in that, you know, he's been in that part of the country, you know, forever, ever since the Sonics moved to OKC. There are a lot of things that line up for him there. And like you say, the money all spends the same. You go to New York, you get less money, and it costs you 30% more to live than it does in OKC. You know, you came from Kansas City.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a cost benefit analysis, I mean, what is Kevin Durant not making now from a financial standpoint that he would be making in New York? I mean, it's not like he's some underground, kind of guy that we haven't quite heard of. It's not like it's a guy that could be potentially, you know, needing a million different endorsements. You know, yeah, could he be a more popular guy in New York? I suppose, but it's not as though he's under the radar. So cost of living and making far less money and having a worse chance at winning, I just think none of it lines up well for Kevin Durant to even sniff the Knicks.
Damon Amendola with us, CBS Sports Radio. D.A., we opened the show, of course, in this neck of the woods here in Alabama, near Tennessee, obviously, with the news that Pat Summitt's, sudden, you know, she's just really fading fast. And I never had an appreciation for it till I got to Tennessee in 2007. and just how important she was, and then just how impressive a woman she was. I had several opportunities to interview her over the years, and got to sit with her a couple of times. Even got stared down by her one time as well. Your impression, you know, as a New Yorker, somebody more on the outside, having lived in this part of this in the country, about Pat Summitt and what she actually means to Title IX, to women's basketball, to women's sports. Is she bigger than women's sports? You know, just your thoughts on Pat Summitt.
Well, I think Pat Summitt crosses any type of gender boundaries. I don't think that there's a male sports fan alive that thinks that Pat Summitt was anything less than a great coach, not a great women's coach, not a great female coach, just because of her demeanor, of her intensity, of what she built to Tennessee, of the pros, of the all-time greats she coached, and how she handled herself. I mean, that to me, the fact that Gina Auriemma and Pat Summitt had obviously a respect for one another, but a real rivalry, says that this was beyond a women's game or beyond a female coach. This was one of the boys. This was one of the great coaches of all time, no matter the gender. And I don't even think you really had to be really into the women's game or in the state of Tennessee to recognize it. I mean, I always felt as though Pat Summitt was very Vince Lombardi or Bear Bryant-esque. She was a leader of humans. She was a leader of athletes. She was a leader of players. And she was as tough as nails as a competitor as you were ever going to find. So it's really sad, obviously, the story that's taken its turn, because it doesn't feel like that long ago that she was prowling the sidelines and as you said, kind of casting the death stares everywhere. And she's one of the greatest coaches of all time, no matter the sport, no matter the gender. No ifs, ands, or buts. You know, believe you me, whether it's Bear or whether it's Vince Lombardi or whether it's any old school coach, they would be very proud to be sitting next to Pat Summitt and breaking down X's and O's.
And the interesting thing is that before there was Bear Bryant, you know, there was Newt Rockne and, you know, and other great college coaches, and the game was already, you know, very, very big in America. Before there was Vince Lombardi, there was George Halas and Paul Brown and other great coaches, and the NFL was already going. Before there was Pat Summitt, there was no women's basketball. I mean, really, there wasn't. I mean, she's like Babe Ruth, you know what I mean? She's more Newt Rockne than she is anything else when it comes to, you know, an analogy there. And even Gina Auriemma, who certainly had his war of words with her over the years and can be a very swarmy guy, as mellowed in his later years, he has the upper hand on all of the records now. He if you were just going sheer numbers, you know, he's the greatest women's coach in the history of women's basketball. But even he has acknowledged that there is no Gina Auriemma. There's no UConn basketball. There's none of that. If it wasn't for the bar that was set by Pat Summitt.
Yeah, she built not only a program, but in a lot of ways a sport. And at the very least, she set the bar for greatness. And then UConn was forced to have to jump as high as that bar and to climb over that bar. So she's a pioneer. She's a legend. She is one of the greats of all time. And she created a culture and created a sport in a lot of ways. And help drag women's basketball into the forefront and create the modern game. And I just always got the sense from listening to her, reading articles about her, listening to her speak, watching her teams, whatever, that she's just as old school and as traditional and as great as any of the greatest coaches we've ever seen. And just would fit in so well with any of them. I mean, again, I imagine a sports bar in heaven, and thankfully she's not there yet, but a sports bar in heaven or a coach's film room in heaven that has Newt Rockne and Bear Bryant and, you know, you name your greats, and Summitt would be right there mixing it up, being able to break it all down with everybody. I mean, I think she's one of the rare women in sports that transcends gender. I don't think you think of her from a women's standpoint. You just think of her as a all-time great, no matter what.
And even though I hate the comparisons, between the records that she set and, like, you know, Dean Smith and so on, and when she passed, became the all-time winningest coach in college basketball history. And I would always chide me wrong, man. I would always say, no, that's not right. You know, that she's the greatest women's basketball coach. It's a different sport, different competitive levels in terms of the depth of field and so on. You can't compare, you know, her numbers with the numbers of a male coach. But having said that, she could have coached the dudes. I think she would have been very successful. She could have coached the dudes. What do you think?
I agree because I think she had a demeanor that that would connect with male athletes. She had a focus. She had an edge. She had a toughness. I mean, there was nothing soft about Pat Summitt. There was nothing overly emotional about Pat Summitt. There was nothing that a male counterpart couldn't relate to. She was a dogged, hard, focused, grinding coach. And I think that's what really the legacy is for Pat Summitt, is that her women's teams at Tennessee played unlike women had ever played before. They were coached, I believe, like men, and I believe it's also a reason why Geno has now been so good, is that Geno obviously has an ability to connect with his players, but Geno, I don't think, treats his female athletes as anything but just simply athletes. And I absolutely believe if Pat Summitt walked onto your field to coach, or walked onto your court to coach basketball, that whether you're a guy or a girl, I think you would respond. I think that's the type of tact she had, and that's what made her team so good. I don't think she bent over at all because she was coaching women. She just said, we're going to win, and I'm going to lead the way, and I'm going to get every last thing I can out of you. And it didn't matter if you were a female. She was going to come at you no matter what.
Yeah, Bruce Pearl used to tell me when he was at Tennessee, he'd tell me that he would go into her office and talk X's and O's with her. He would actually get X's and O's advice. He'd say, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And you know, they would, you know, he would pick her brain from an X's and O's standpoint, a pure basketball standpoint. She had that kind of a basketball mind. There's no question about it. David Amendola with us. So, D.A., before I let you go, some hardball notes. A-Rod held out of the lineup tonight. Second game in a row, he's a healthy scratch. And he said, I'm a little surprised. I've been here a long time. I want to be out there every day. I want to contribute. All you can do is control your attitude and your work ethic and feel good about both. He's got zero trade value. I'm on record as saying I'd outright him. I mean, I'd just go ahead and release him, put Carlos Beltran in there as the DH, get one of the young guys playing in left field. Beltran can't play the field really anymore, but he could still rake. Is this kind of end ugly here? What do you think is going to happen here with A-Rod, who's got the rest of this season and all of next year to go in terms of the money that he's owed, which would mean he's owed about $40 million?
Yeah, because of that, I think the Yankees are going to hold on to him, not just from a financial standpoint, because they don't want to just eat it, because if they really had to, they could. I think we're now at this awkward stage where the Yankees are going to hold on to him, because when he starts passing milestones, they want to cash in on it. Because if he's not going to be a great baseball player, at least he can make them money. And that was such a big reason they signed him to this monster deal and kind of bid against themselves. And that was because the Steinbrenners and the organization said, well, when he gets to 700 and when he gets to 661 and he gets to 700 and when he gets to 715 and 716 and then potentially beyond, if he can catch bonds, every one of those benchmarks, it's going to be a chase, and we're going to sell tickets, or we're going to sell T-shirts, or we're going to sell memorabilia, and we need to do that. And that's why they spent all that money on that awful contract extension. And I don't think they're going to cut bait now. I mean, we're closing in on a lot of those big-time milestones for A-Rod, and as bad as he's been, he's going to hit a few of those in the next year and a half of playing. So I think they're going to be forced to keep him around and hope that, and because they realize they're not a very good baseball team anyway, they're not going to be really in a pennant race this year. And so what do you got? What you got is a strange brew in the Bronx of not enough young players to make it feel like they're moving forward with youth, and not enough good players to make it feel like they're competitive. So A-Rod's going to be one of the only things that keeps them, quote-unquote, relevant or interesting, I think.
And over at Citi Field, the Mets, of course, they went to Atlanta and struggled again with the Braves, the suddenly hot Braves, now 7-3 in their last 10. But there, so are the Marlins 7-3 in their last 10 after taking 3 of 4 from the suddenly scuffling Cubs. And now Miami has tied the Mets 3 games behind Washington, which has lost 7 out of the last 10 games. What do you think about that Marlin team?
No idea what to expect. I have no idea. It has been a kind of a bizarre baseball season already. You alluded to some of these things. And I kind of feel like we don't have our sea legs in baseball anymore until well after the trade deadline. You know, if you gave me August 1st, I could maybe sense, okay, who I thought were contenders or pretenders. But now with the second wild card, with a league that is so dependent on the home run and the strikeout from a pitching standpoint, with offense wildly down besides the home run, I think it's really tough to know what's going to click until later on in the season. So it's, you know, I feel like this as a Mets fan, and I talk about this with my buddies all the time. The Mets just need to stay within shouting distance, I feel, of the Nationals and get to August 1st within 5 games of the division. They've been there because at that point, I think your team starts to feel more full and more complete and you have a better sense of who you are. But with the modern kind of strain on pitchers and the constant DL stints that so many pitchers go on now, with the reliance on the bullpens and the home run or the strikeout, I just think it's all so volatile that it's kind of hard to take anything before even July 1 and have any real significance to it. And it's probably more like August 1, August 15th before you really have a good grasp on things.
That's a great point, and I will say this, too. You know how much I am a traditionalist, and for me, I love the Pittsburgh Pirates in their vest tops, you know, their 1960s-style vest tops and so on. But I'm digging the old 79, We Are Family gear is
there
good.
The go. Only
man, that's good stuff. The only problem is they don't wear it right. You know what I mean? That's why the kid looked like he was wearing his pajamas on his pullover, you know, when he was pitching the kid last night, making his debut in the major leagues and stuff. And the problem is they just don't wear the gear right. You know, we and I have talked about this before, man. You got to wear the polyester gear, the pullover gear, the no belt gear. You got to wear that snug fitting mid-calf stirrups. McCutcheon's got one kind of sock on. Other guys have the pants long. They're baggy. The shirts look like they're way too big, like they got them at the Men's Warehouse or something. I mean, they're not wearing it right, but it's pretty cool stuff.
Totally agree. See, now, dog, you're coming around on this. And I'm totally with you. I love the We Are Family Pirates. I love yesterday on Sundays at home how the White Sox wear the ones from 83, the Tony La Russa, Harold Baines years. I love those, the old softball uniforms. I love the Mets with the racing stripes from 86. The problem is, as you said, you've got to wear it a little tighter, and I just wish that they would all acquiesce and say, okay, we've got the throwbacks. Everybody choose a size, one size smaller, okay? It's not going to kill you. Don't worry. You're not going to choke to death. Just one size smaller than you usually wear. If you usually wear a large, let's go medium. You usually wear an extra large, let's go large. Just make it look a little cleaner, a little bit more fit, because the designs are so awesome.
It is good stuff. It really was good stuff. And of course, with the Dodgers pretty much wearing what they wore back then, it did, to me, I was 18, 19 years old then. To me, it was like partying like it was 1978 all over again. So 79 all over again. All right, man. Damon Amendola has been our guest. DA, appreciate you as always. Great work. And have a great 4th of July as well. And maybe we'll catch up on Tuesday next week.
All right, sounds good, big dog. Enjoy the vacation. Much deserved. I'll talk to you later.